We're doing an expository treatment of 1 Timothy. We've been doing this once a month, and so this evening is our opportunity to study from 1 Timothy chapter 3. In a previous lesson, we did a short overview of elders. We introduced something about their role and responsibilities, did some background work, and then we looked at the qualifications of 1 Timothy 3, only from the standpoint of one topic, and that's what we're doing, is breaking these qualifications up into topics. And so we talked about elements of age and experience, which the notion of age comes into the picture when you think of the word elder. You're thinking of someone who is not younger. That is not a defined parameter, that is being elder. But we noticed from the qualifications, it's one that's not a novice in the faith, a mature family man. He must have believing children and be the husband of one wife, and his children must be under his authority. He rules his own household well, and so that is a gauge, that is a marker about one's ability to handle spiritual oversight in a local church. And we also notice the qualification, able to teach. That doesn't happen early necessarily in one's life. It certainly is not developed overnight. And so those are some elements of age and experience, though again, God does not set a particular age limit, lower or upper, on the service of an elder. So tonight we're going to look at pretty much the rest of the qualifications under different headings. So the first one I want to think about is elements of temperament. Elements of temperament. So in the New King James Version, and that's the version I'll be referring to, in 1 Timothy 3:2, we have the term self-controlled. And so we noted in our previous lesson that some of the qualifications of being an elder are absolute, and some are relative. So there are some that an element of judgment is, in fact, quite a number, I think, that an element of judgment is brought into the picture on examining a particular brother to see whether or not he fulfills these qualifications. So there are degrees of some of these, and then some are fairly black and white. So in regard to self-control, I think there's a number of things we can think about here. In fact, I think temperate is actually the term in the New King James Version. Other ones might say self-controlled. Is there evidence that a man acts with deliberation and moderation rather than impulsively or haphazardly? I think that is one way we can analyze this qualification. Is he ruled by something, or maybe I should say anything other than God? Is he ruled by something? Is his life completely immersed in something that especially would not be of a spiritual nature? Is he ruled by something, or does he have control of his own spirit? Is he able to say no to something that may be a habit or an entertainment, something that he enjoys doing? Is he able to keep it in balance and say no? That's beginning to get out of hand or control me or take away from my spiritual obligations. Is a man financially undisciplined? Or does he control, again, his finances? This may be one who is, as I said a moment ago, perhaps disqualified by questionable entertainment practices. Is he so taken with whatever, I'm not picking on anything, but the internet or internet gaming or movies or sports, whatever it may be, but is consumed by that to the point that he can't put it aside and say, you know what, that's beginning to dominate my thinking. Is this a man, you know, that we may be considering for that role in being an elder who speaks inadvisably? Maybe not maliciously, but doesn't control his words very well and may even speak injuriously on occasion. Does he control his tongue, or does his tongue control him? That's not an exhaustive list, but I'm trying to just put before you some things that you might try to measure or see in a man that would indicate whether he is a person of self-control. again, these have to be applied. And application is not always easy in regard to relative qualifications. Another term here to consider in regard to elements of temperament would be sober-minded. I would say, among other things, an elder must be clearly focused on his task, understanding what it is that's important to do in life and being able to focus on that. His deliberations must be rational rather than emotional. We see an awful lot in our culture right now of emotional thinking. Shallow emotional thinking. And not showing much of an ability to rationally look at evidence and then decide what is and what is not or what ought to be. An elder is going to be called on to discern arguments, sometimes very fine lines of delineation, identify motives of the unscrupulous, not by assuming, but by looking at the fruit of one's life. He must reasonably foresee, reasonably being an important word, reasonably foresee the implications of decisions. That's very hard to do if you haven't figured that out yet. Sometimes you do what you think is absolutely the right thing, and there's some hidden element somewhere that you didn't think about or was not apparent, and the decision ends up not being one that accomplishes what you wanted it to. But I do think there is an element in this sober-mindedness of having good judgment and being able to look down the road at the implications of one's decisions. He must have resolve in the face of criticism. Again, thinking with clarity and sober-mindedness and not being so wishy-washy that he collapses under criticism. A flighty, uncertain, reactionary man is unsuited to do the work of an elder. And there's more to be said under any of these qualifications, but we'll move on. I've sort of packaged the next ones into not violent, gentle, and not quarrelsome. So I'm going to put all of those together. Not violent, opposite, gentle, and not quarrelsome. So taken together, again, with a slant here on the temperament of an elder, we might say calm, cool, and collected. That he's able to rein in his emotions, his reactions, to think, as we've said, soberly, with self-control, and not overreact to things. He's not easily provoked, because as an elder, there will be many temptations to anger and defensiveness. You've got people disagreeing, and sometimes unreasonably so. And I mentioned this morning, we're studying in the high school class 2 Corinthians. Can you imagine being the Apostle Paul? Now, he's not an elder, but it illustrates this characteristic. But you're the Apostle Paul. The Lord has appeared to you and directly commissioned you as an apostle. And by that interaction, you've realized how wrong you were in your adherence to Judaism. So you immediately convert to Christ. You begin preaching the gospel, and then you're selected by Christ to go out and be the primary teacher of the Gentiles, and you faithfully do that, enduring persecutions and beatings and exposure and arduous travel. You go through all that only to have a group of people stand up and say, you've got no right to tell anybody what to do. You didn't walk with the Lord. You weren't there when he worked his miracles or whatever other thing. I mean, there were a lot of other things being said about Paul. You're a rotten preacher. Can't stand to listen to you. You're not very eloquent. And he accused of being a hypocrite in what he writes as opposed to how he appears in person. I mean, on and on, the list of challenges to Paul goes. And so I guess I would say about all that, do you think it would be any different to be an elder? Do you think everybody's going to like you because you're an elder? Everybody's going to always support you and encourage you and never disagree with you? And unreasonably so sometimes. Sometimes people may have criticisms of the elders that have some substance to them. But these things I was mentioning about Paul, none of them had any substance. It didn't stop them from coming. And Paul dealt with them, again, 2 Corinthians, it's a great book. But Paul dealt with them with great self-control, thinking very carefully through how he was going to respond to those arguments without himself falling into sin. Among the Lord's people, let's step outside and settle it doesn't have a place. And lest you think I'm you know, joking or making that up. That happened in the 50s and 60s when the issues were at full bore. Somebody invited my father out one time in a business meeting to fight. Not qualified to be an elder, we could say that. So on the other hand, let's not confuse being gentle with being cowardly. There comes a time when evil will have to be confronted. It will have to be withstood. It can be given no quarter. So to say not violent, gentle, not quarrelsome is not to say uncourageous or not willing to take a stand. Just letting things happen because you don't want to be confrontational. But even so, those kinds of things must be in a measured way, not with abuse, not with vindictiveness, not with using inappropriate language or impugning motives. And so those are kind of a package that, again, they kind of point back to sober-minded and self-controlled, actually. That's why I've put all these under the heading of temperament. And then I borrowed one from Titus 1:7. A couple of these are going to come from Titus. I didn't want to leave some of these out. But not self-willed as in Titus 1:7. There's a delicate balance between advising in matters of wisdom and imposing one's personal views on others. Not self-willed. So here's how this can work. When an elder sees someone in danger, spiritual danger, or drifting in the congregation, it's easy to be overcome with zeal and a desire to see them do the right thing that you then respond with a heavy hand. And neither we nor the Lord nor apostles can demand faith of anyone. Paul makes that clear too in writing to the Corinthians. I'm not trying to impose my will on you. I'm trying to persuade you. I'm trying to reason with you, again, which is what 2 Corinthians is all about. On the other hand, it may be that an older elder may preempt a younger elder, thinking that, well, he's less experienced than I am, therefore he can't possibly be as sharp or maybe correct on this issue as maybe the way that I see it. I worked with an eldership before that were two older men and two younger men. And for the most part, it worked. But at times, there was some clash because of the age differential. Peter, in 1 Peter 5:3, in talking about shepherds, elders, says, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Now, that doesn't mean an elder is only to be an example. But what Peter's doing there is amplifying what he means, especially by not lording it over the brethren. It's not Mark and I's job as elders to push you or anybody in the congregation in a direction we want you to go with force. The greatest impact I think you can have in trying to help others go the right direction is to lead and do and maybe model is part of that. But again, think of the terminology we're using here. It's that of a shepherd. Shepherds do not drive. Shepherds lead. So an elder is not an administrative position where Mark and I sit in a room somewhere and we sort of make decisions and then pass those decisions along and expect everybody to line up to that. That's not the way this works. So those are elements of temperament and what traits, personality traits, you may bring to the table. But also, the obvious point here is that these are things that need to be worked on through our lives. These are qualities that we all really need to be working on to develop in our lives, but they must be present in an elder. And again, some of those are relatively determined. Titus 1:8, we'll move to the next category, which is evidence of moral purity. Evidence of moral purity. So Titus 1:8 says, lover of what is good and holy. Not what is good and holy, but he must be holy, and he must be a lover of what is good. And I would take that to be that an elder has a genuine desire to live purely and decently. according to God's will, God's standards, God's values. He's not privately engaged in morally tainted activities. That is, there's a public face to an elder and a private face to an elder. And you might learn some rather shocking things if you consider the private face. That doesn't mean everybody's got a right to your computer. But if people were to learn about things done in secrecy, what might they conclude? So this is a man that would truly seek things that are beneficial to himself and to others, things that are godly. He tries to maintain an impeccable reputation because of the position that he is in, and one, and because of the relationship that he sustains with Christ, which really is more important. But that leads him to be truly not just acting a part, but a lover of what is good. I want to see in myself and others that which is righteous, that which is holy. 1 Timothy 3:3 says, not given to wine. So again, we're dealing with the category of evidence of moral purity. And in regard to this, I would just generally make an observation that any Christian, but especially an elder, needs all of his mental, emotional, and spiritual faculties in optimum working order. That is especially crucial among elders who are trying to oversee and guide and shepherd the lives of other people. And what is so contrary to that is to allow yourself to be compromised by chemicals. Wine is an interesting word, and it takes a bigger study than what we can do with it here tonight. But the word is generic. It can mean the juice that is still in the grape. It can mean juice that's been squeezed out of a grape and not fermented. It can mean fermented. You can do copious studies on how wine, using again the broadest use of the term, how wine could be processed in that day, in many cases so that it did not become alcoholic. I think we tend to have the assumption that grape juice just naturally becomes alcoholic wine over the course of time. But that's not true, because there's all kinds of ways in which you can manipulate that process to either make fermentation, you know, more effective or affect the taste of wine. So I hear. I don't drink it myself. But this is a complicated process. It's not something that, if they had grape juice, they automatically had fermented wine. That's really not the case. But wine, beer, fermented or distilled beverages, when they begin impairing our judgment, there is a serious problem there. For any Christian, but especially here, we're thinking about an elder. We now know more accurately what the effects of alcohol are in the system. They did not have the kind of blood study that we can do now. And so I do realize there is a question of what drunkenness may have involved in that day and time. But when we think about what we know about alcohol now, we ought to be even more sensitive to it, because we realize it does compromise our nervous system, and it doesn't take much at all to do that. And our perceptions of things, even our physical perceptions, not just our mental perceptions, and our judgment is affected by the presence of alcohol in our system. Alcohol impairment is inconsistent with what we've already said tonight about self-control, sound judgment, and purity. We're talking about things that do not mix. And I'll just throw this in for free, but we're talking about a country that we live in that has 10,000 other options. That's probably a low number of things we can drink that do not do these things to us. And with an elder having to make very fine, careful, rational decisions on things, it seems to me to be the last thing an elder would want to do is be drinking alcohol. And let me just put this in a very practical sense. Suppose you had the day that I've had today. And you say, I need some encouragement. You call me up and say, Jim, I've lost a couple of people that are close to me. Would you please come to my house and I'd like to talk about this and maybe let's have a prayer? And I say, sure, I'll be glad to. I'll be right there. And I show up at your house and the first thing you smell on my breath is alcohol. Let me ask you a question. Does that inspire confidence in you toward me? That I show up at your house smelling like alcohol, and now I want to say a prayer and I want to advise you on spiritual things? I mean, come on, to ask the question is to answer it. And yet, there's a growing number of people that just think there's absolutely nothing wrong with voluntarily, willfully imbibing alcohol that we know is destructive to mind and body. Boggles my mind why we want to do that, but we do. One thing is clear, I think, too, in regard to the self-control element here. An elder who can't or won't leave alcohol alone or any other mind-altering chemical lacks the spiritual substance for leadership. If there is an issue here, and I believe there is, and a man, a prospective elder, says, I am not going to stop drinking my alcohol, then you have an answer as to whether he's qualified to be an elder. I'm not giving up my alcohol. What did we just say earlier? Are you ruled by something, or does something rule you? Self-control, didn't we say that's one of the earlier qualifications? Self-control? Well, if you simply will not give up something that you like, it's not a necessity. It's something you like. You're not willing to give that up because there's moral fog about it? I think you have an answer. Then 1 Timothy 3:3 says, not greedy for money. Not greedy for money. Wealthy and greedy are not synonymous. To be wealthy does not mean you're greedy. And if you're greedy, it doesn't mean you have wealth. You can be greedy and be poor. A man can become wealthy because he invested in his education, the choice of vocation, inheritance, dumb luck. You discovered the one thing that could sell, you know, 5 million items, and fad, be whatever it is, people think they got to have it and they buy it and the thing dies out, and now you've made a pile of money on basically maybe stumbling up on something that sold, the public was sold on, and you sold to the public. And so to be wealthy is not necessarily to be greedy, and there are a lot of wealthy elders in the Lord's church, and that's a wonderful thing if they understand their wealth properly. But not greedy for money. How might you know that? A man who works to the neglect of his family, maybe, who lives beyond his means, who manifests a lack of contentment with what he has, constantly pushing, 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 striving for more, bigger, fancier. I don't want a turboprop. I want, you know, a jet. I don't want a jet. I want a three-engine jet. You know, there's really no end to this when you start getting into the world of greed and acquisitiveness, acquisition. So the man who is greedy for money is the man that will neglect other things in order to continue to feed this desire. He'll either neglect his duties in pursuit of his acquisitions, or he'll be negatively influenced, perhaps in the responsible disbursement of the funds of the church. There is an element of expenditure that would come from the oversight of the elders. And so if you have an imbalanced view of money, it can affect the way that, and as we, what do? When we take up the collection, we often pray for the elders to have wisdom. I thank you for that prayer. It's needed. How do we disperse these funds? And to do it in a way that would glorify God. But greed and materialism, which are, generally speaking, problems in our culture because we're wealthy, are, I think, surface cracks that point to a deeper spiritual cause. There's something missing deeper in the soul that people then try to make up for with material things. More to be said on all of these again. But then the third major topic this evening is evidence of good influence. So 1 Timothy 3:2, we find the term blameless. That's actually a term that's somewhat common in Scripture, describing those that we might put in the category of godliness. The idea here is not being above accusation. I mean, think about it. Was Jesus above accusation? No. They accused him of a lot of things. Could they make it stick? Were they substantive? Were they able to condemn Jesus? Well, Jesus, you said this, but we saw you do that. No, they could not do that. So blameless doesn't mean there's no way anybody could ever say anything negative about you. An elder must be not guilty of a substantive charge, that is, not due censure or reprimand or correction, because he is in fact in the wrong. And so, again, I think the word blameless is talking about a general characterization of a man's life. That there are not one or perhaps multiple people standing up and pointing fingers and saying, we know you do this, or we saw you do that. You bring questions into people's judgments of you by various things that you do, and those charges have some substance to them. So again, it's not merely the accusation, it's a substantive accusation. Blameless doesn't mean never did anything wrong. I have seen this before too. I have seen people object to men as deacons and elders because of something that happened 25 or 30 years before. I've seen a man withdraw his name from consideration as an elder because of that sort of a thing. Well, I know that when I worked with him way back here at so-and-so, he did this, and the man had repented and done whatever he could to correct that. But at least one person who was considering him never could get past that. So sometimes we arbitrarily set standards that, you know, pretty much no human being could ever meet. That's not what these qualifications are for. To basically set a bar so high nobody could ever meet it. What they're designed to do is help us identify who is spiritually strong, wise, has their lives in order, demonstrating that they could, in fact, shepherd and lead God's people, rather than succumb to the pressures that may come to someone in that role. Peter identifies himself as a fellow elder in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1, but he not only denied the Lord, we know that very well, but that was fairly early in his spiritual life. But beyond that, he shunned the Gentiles in Antioch when the Judaizers came from Jerusalem and dragged Barnabas into it with him, Galatians 2, 11 and 12. And yet, he refers to himself as a fellow elder, a shepherd of God's people. But generally speaking, when we think of blameless, if we're giving ammunition, as it were, to others to question on a substantive level, sometimes it's easy to mix in opinions with this, but if there's a substantive charge, we end up giving cause, we give reason to others to oppose us, we're in essence squandering the moral capital that we need in order to lead God's people, because it is leading by agreement and concession on the part of the congregation. 1 Timothy 3:7 says that he must have a good testimony among unbelievers. This is interesting. And it's going to be one of those that perhaps could be very difficult to execute. How do I interview, how do I examine a prospective elder's non-Christian associates? That may be somewhat challenging. But nonetheless, the whole principle, I think, here is that an elder must have the respect not only of the brethren, but the community at large. He must be recognized as a man of integrity and solid character, even if the world disagrees with his views, which it will, if he's a faithful man, faithful to the Scriptures. The world will not generally agree with his views, but they will be able to speak to his character. This man is not a hypocrite. He truly lives what he believes. We see that in his life at work. We see that in the neighborhood or whatever peerage we may be talking about. It's easy to put on an act of holiness when around select company where that's important. But what if a man relaxes those standards and sinks to the level of his non-Christian associates? So it may be that there are those who see us in a different light depending on who it is that we're around. I remember one story told one time of a man in a congregation where we lived, and he was in a hardware store, and he was at the counter talking to the person behind the counter, and another person walked in behind him, and the brother didn't know that another brother had walked in behind him, and the second brother heard some of the most foul language coming out of that man's mouth. Surprise when you turn around and see your brother in Christ standing there listening to every word you're saying. But the point is, we need to be what we are. And this is the whole idea of course, behind the word hypocrite is wearing a mask from the acting application. Wearing a mask, holding the mask up like they used to do. That we're the same person in the community, we're the same person in our family at home, we're the same person among the brethren at worship. We need to be consistent, we are what we are, and not someone else depending on the situation. Titus 1:8, just, fair, equitable treatment afforded to all, not showing favoritism. An elder must have a deep sense of what is right, not what is popular, and not favoring certain ones because they're liked or you like them as a person, but as it were, right is right and wrong is wrong. And it doesn't matter who it is that's under consideration in that regard. And then the last one tonight that we'll talk about, and then we'll wind up with some comments. But hospitable, 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2, an elder, and I will say, and his wife, parenthetically, because no, his wife is not an elder, but so many of these things will, I think, in some measure, be matters of influence by his wife. But especially this one. An elder must be generous, helpful, concerned with the welfare of others. Maybe we'll say a people person. Not everyone is by nature gregarious, extroverted, comfortable around others. But I do think that the idea of hospitable goes beyond personality. Hospitable doesn't mean that you're gregarious. You can be hospitable without that. This involves the will. It's being willing to see the needs of those around you and be willing and able to provide for those needs if at all possible. So an elder cannot be aloof or unconcerned or distanced from the brethren. Now, again, these all happen in relative degrees within a congregation. An elder cannot know everyone in great detail. And so this is where all of us help this process of seeing to and caring for one another, like Philippians 2, is not just addressed to elders. But you can't look at the congregation and say, I really don't care what's happening in somebody's life, or somebody needs something, and well, you know, maybe one of the deacons will take care of that. An elder cares about others, shares his home, shares his food, shares his time with whatever is needed. I think all of that comes under the heading of hospitality. You're willing to open your life to other people. I know with some elders it is more difficult than others because some do have that natural, gregarious, outgoing disposition, can talk to a stranger, and then other people are more reserved in their personality. But again, I think this goes beyond personality. So let me just wrap this up with some observations. There are differences in application relative to these qualifications. In fact, the challenge that a congregation has is to go through this process of evaluating a prospective elder, and that can become corrosive in congregations because you have differences of how the different qualifications are going to be applied. I've recently heard of a controversy in a local church concerning a newly appointed elder as to whether or not the man is qualified on more than one count. And he's already been appointed, but there's now some unrest concerning some of the qualifications as they apply to him. So this process of evaluating men for the eldership can itself be very problematic. We need to study diligently the qualifications and separate traditions, opinions, and preferences from what the qualifications are actually designed to identify in men. That is easier said than done. Some people will never be happy because they don't want to cede control in the congregation. It is extremely difficult for a church that either doesn't have elders or never had them to appoint them. And the reason oftentimes is brethren don't want to give up control. I want to have my say, and if elders are appointed and I'm not one of them, I'm going to lose my voice in the business meeting. So this is a process that is can be fraught with difficulty. Fortunately, in the years that I have been here, we've had two different changes of elders, and it's not turned into a matter of division or controversy, and thank the Lord for that, and thank the brethren for that. But it can be very volatile in some places. Winding our thoughts down, I'm going to read this. Somebody that I respect and I know personally wrote it. You may disagree with it, and that's fine. I'll be happy to talk about it. But he makes an observation, I think, that is worthy of thought, and it may run against your grain. He writes, "Now, since it is generally conceded that congregations look out among them who will be set in this position, it follows that those whose heart is inclined toward spiritual, toward things spiritual, and who have demonstrated their concern for the church be the ones whose voice be considered in this matter. The inexperienced youth, the novices, and the dissidents should have no part nor parcel in the matter for various, though obvious, reasons." Chew on that. Because I have been in business meetings where the general prevailing notion is everybody has a say from a 12-year-old to an 85-year-old. And I think unthinkingly we arrive at that conclusion by saying, well, you know, everybody's a member here. Well, nobody questions that. The question isn't membership. The question is maturity. The question is knowledge. The question is wisdom. And again, I have seen a good man torpedoed by the yak-yakers in the congregation that were never happy anywhere, so they kept jumping from congregation to congregation. And on the morning of the appointment, they basically stood up, they went to the elder and said, if you appoint that man as a deacon, it wasn't an elder, we're leaving. I don't mean to be flippant, but my answer, I think, as an elder would have been, let me get the door for you. This is not the place for politics. It certainly is not the place for imposing my will on the congregation. That's exactly what that brother did. I'm going to impose my will on the congregation. The elders at that time should have considered the source and appointed the man to be a deacon and held the door for the other one. So much damage has been done in churches where the good among the congregation is trying to carry out the commands of the Lord and organize the congregation in the right way and properly evaluate men and follow a procedure in what they're doing, only to cave in to some dissident that at the end of the day and the end of the process jumps up and says, wait a minute, I don't like what you're about to do. This is not the way this should be handled among God's people, and too often it is. The Lord wants us to have shepherds in local churches. A church without shepherds is incomplete. I'm not saying it's illegitimate. It is incomplete. And I think, hopefully, in seeing some things that this church has gone through, including the last year, and this is, again, not praise for Mark and me personally, it's just simply, it is best to deal with the Lord's business, and especially potential difficulties like COVID, by having shepherds and not having business meetings. And you men that have been in them, you know what I'm talking about. I don't have to say a whole lot more about that. These qualifications are here because elders that hold the title, hold the position, if you will, but without the character can do great damage. But great damage can be done without elders in a congregation. And so by all means, my brothers here tonight, let us be working on developing these qualities so that we can be of service in this capacity one day, if by the will of God and other things in life, perhaps beyond our control, fall into place correctly. Some things happen in life and you can't control that. They happen to you. They don't happen because of you. But the things that we can control, which is developing these kinds of qualities and characteristics, so much are in our control. And the question is, men, are we working to develop these things? Do we keep these things we've been talking about the last couple of lessons in mind so that they're a goal for us? We're working toward that, not because we want to be elder, but because it is a service. It is a vital and an important service to God's people. And local churches with qualified elders function better and function optimally than those without them. I've been in both situations. I preached for the first 14 years without elders. I know what it's like to be without elders. And it can be very, very unsettling to me as a preacher at the time and to a congregation. So thank the Lord for shepherds and for men that are working and striving to grow into that role. Not to be served. God doesn't give us authority or position to be served. It is so we can serve. That's what it's about. It's about serving in the best way possible. So I know there are lots and lots of questions and issues and fine shades of application that come from these things, but at least we need to start with a baseline of trying to understand what are the qualifications and how do I understand them before we can then apply them. So I hope the last couple of lessons on this subject has helped us do that. In the next of these installments next month, we'll deal with deacons, as Mark read through this morning regarding Justin. Take out your song books. We're going to sing a song of encouragement, and it's to encourage. And if there's someone here tonight that needs encouragement to right something that is wrong or needing help and encouragement, drawing closer to the Lord, we can help you with prayer. We can help you with counsel or words of encouragement. If you have any spiritual need at all, would you come while we stand?